Okay, so we can continue with the 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas. We have looked at two sets of four, the four right efforts and the four right mindfulnesses, or the four kinds of mindfulness meditation. And the next set of fours is the four Iddhipadas, which I've here translated as the four foundations of spiritual power. There is a kind of a sequence here, because the four efforts are about the preliminary purification of the mind, and then you have the Satipatthana, which is all about the meditation that leads you to samadhi, and the four foundations of spiritual power are really about samadhi practice itself. So it is kind of one step, as a natural progression here, even though in the 37 it actually comes in a different sequence. Here, the way I've structured here, it is a natural progression. And the word Iddhipada, the word Iddhi in Pali means something like power or splendor or potency or something like that. And it is used in many different contexts. It can refer to worldly kind of power, like a king has an Iddhi, for example, the Iddhi of the king, the power of the king. Or it is more often used in a spiritual context, where it means the kind of powers of the mind that you use for whatever purpose. But it is often used in connection with kind of supernormal powers. But remember, in Buddhism, the idea of supernormal powers also includes things like awakening itself. So it has that important aspect of it in the on the path. Iddhi is like the powers of awakening, or the powers of recalling your past life. And pada means like a step or a foot. So it is like a step, one of the four steps to spiritual power, or the four foundations, or whatever you want to call it. So this is what this is about. And as I mentioned before, this kind of slots into the Noble Eightfold Path, the last three factors of the path: right effort, right mindfulness, and also right samadhi. The focus is on right samadhi, but all these other factors are also kind of included within that. And there is a Sangyutta, a section of connected discourses that deal with the Iddhipadas. It is not terribly interesting, it's not that much in there, but there are a couple of suttas that I thought might be interesting, just to throw a bit of light what is meant by these Iddhipadas, these spiritual powers. So let's have a look at one of these suttas, 52nd Sangyutta of the Connected Discourses of the Buddha, sutta number 13. And this is like a definition of what these Iddhipadas are all about. This sutta is called immersion due to enthusiasm, or if you like, samadhi due to enthusiasm, or to desire even, or to wanting, or something like that. Mendicants, if a mendicant depends on enthusiasm, on chanda, in order to gain samadhi, gain unification of mind, this is called samadhi due to enthusiasm. They generate enthusiasm, try, make an effort, exert the mind, and strive so that the bad, unskillful qualities don't arise. They generate enthusiasm, try, make an effort, exert the mind, and strive so that bad, unskillful qualities that have arisen are given up. They generate enthusiasm, try, make an effort, exert the mind, and try so that skillful qualities arise. They generate enthusiasm, try, make an effort, exert the mind, and strive so that skillful qualities that have arisen remain, are not lost, but increase and mature and are fulfilled by development. These are called the active efforts, sankhara padana. And so there is this enthusiasm, this samadhi due to enthusiasm, and these active efforts. And this is called the basis of psychic power, or the basis of spiritual power, that has samadhi due to enthusiasm and active efforts. So that is the definition. It's a bit dry, to say the least. So it doesn't leap out and make you really inspired just by reading that. It's kind of, but so what is the point of all of this? And the point of all of this is, first of all, that you can see that samadhi can be gained depending on a variety of things. And the one thing that is different for each of the four idipadas is this word. You a mendicant, depending on enthusiasm, you gain immersion. So depending on four different things, you gain immersion. So it is the word enthusiasm that is changed out, and then you have different words in that place later on. So that is really the critical thing here. What it is that you use to move you towards immersion or samadhi. So in this case, it is enthusiasm. And enthusiasm, as I mentioned before, is chanda in Pali language. And chanda very often means things like desire or wanting. Yeah, but it is desire in a positive sense, or rather it can be in a positive sense. It can be negative as well, but it can be positive, like a desire to live the spiritual life or desire to keep the precepts or whatever it is. It is all kind of part of that sort of desire, chanda. So you use that chanda to gain samadhi. And why is that the case? You may wonder how that is. Chanda is the stillness of the mind. It is the mind being completely unified. How can chanda and desire lead to samadhi? And I think the point here is that this is the very first of these idipadas. And each one, as you ascend the four, everything in Buddhism is a graduated sequence. Every sequence has a meaning. So the first one is always going to be the most basic one. This is the most basic way of attaining samadhi, when the mind is perhaps at its most coarse. And then the various ways get more and more refined, more and more powerful as you move up this sequence of four. Everything in Buddhism is like that. Very useful to remember that, if you haven't heard it before, the idea that every sequence, every set of qualities, they always come in a certain order, and the order is always significant when you read about things. The five hindrances, the Eightfold Path, the five khandhas, everything has there's a significance, maybe not absolutely everything, occasionally may not be, but the vast majority of time there is a significance to the sequence, and the same thing is true here. And of course, once you see that, then you realize that when you start out to attain samadhi, initially, as you start out, the mind is still quite coarse. You need a little bit of desire to even get you there, to get you started out on this spiritual practice to attain samadhi. If you have no desire, nothing is going to happen. You have to have a little bit of wish to kind of watch the breath. First of all, you have to have the wish to meditate at all. If you have no wish to meditate, it's not going to happen. You're going to have to want to meditate a bit. You're going to have to get into your car, drive to Jhana Grove. If you have no desire to come here, it's not going to happen. You have to have the wish to come into the hall, otherwise you're going to stay in bed all day, even here at Jhana Grove. Simple things like that. There's always a little bit of desire that drives you on in these things. And the same thing when you finally sit down, because it is not natural to kind of hang out with the breath. It's more natural to do maybe other things. You have to have a little bit of desire initially to stay with that breath. Something that kind of drives you in that direction. You have to have some feeling that this is important, this matters, this is something you want to do, and then you kind of get enthusiastic about it and inspired about it, and you stay with the breath. But there's a little bit of desire involved. That's just has to be at this particular case. And as you go up these four idipadas, the next one is the virya idipada, depending on energy. The chanda, the desire, becomes less and less, because as you move up, the process becomes more self-sustaining. So here, chanda is the main thing that keeps on the breath. Later on, there are other aspects that are the main thing that keep you with the meditation object. I shouldn't say breath, because here it is not a specific meditation object. Any meditation object will do. So there's less desire as you move up. And this is really all it means. Some desire is required at the very beginning here. And it's useful to remember that, because sometimes you may come to a very skilled meditator and all they do is just sit down and bang, they go into samadhi. And they tell you, all you have to do is just kind of sit down, close your eyes, and bang, you go into samadhi. And it doesn't happen for everyone like that, In fact, it only happens for a very tiny minority of people who have been doing meditation for a long, long time. And for other people, it is necessary initially to have some of this desire to keep you going, But not a lot of, what I mean desire, I mean a very subtle thing in the mind, something very small that just enables you to stay with the breath. So it's not kind of some strong desire, because that is very destructive, but a very subtle thing that keeps you going. So that is how it is dependent on this here called enthusiasm, which is quite nice, because it's a kind of an enthusiastic desire. You want to do this, you know it is a good thing to do. And if you stay with the breath in that way, and as you get closer to samadhi, that enthusiasm, the chanda, that gradually dies down, it becomes more and more of a natural process until you get to some proper samadhi down the track. There is another word used here, unification of mind, chit ekagata, and this is a kind of a synonym for samadhi in the suttas. Ekagata means literally like one. The mind of oneness, ekagata, maybe gone to one, or something like that. No, chit ekaga, one peaked mind. And one peaked mind is the opposite of the distracted mind. The distracted mind, vikitta citta in the suttas, is the one that is, mind is moving around, it is restless, and this is the opposite of the one peaked mind, which is kind of going only to one object all the time. So this is one of the synonyms. It gives you some idea what ekagata is. It is a mind that is completely samadhi is. It is a mind that is completely undistracted. It's the opposite of the distracted mind, fully focused on the object. That's just helpful just to understand the idea of samadhi. So samadhi can happen in many levels. You can talk about some degree of samadhi when you are fully focused on anything, really. But because the mind is not distracted from that object, but ideally it means the full unification in meditation practice. So that is the basic idea. That is the most important idea of what this is about. So nothing all that earth-shattering, really. Then you have the four right efforts that are mentioned here. They are mentioned because that is what kind of keeps you on track in your samadhi practice. This is together with sampajanya and sati and all of these things. It is what enables you to stay with that breath and then develop it until it reaches its maturity and peak of samadhi eventually down the track. So there is some degree of active effort there with all of these things. Padana sankara is the Pali word. So this is what it's called. All of these four things coming together, that is what is called the basis of spiritual power that has immersion due to enthusiasm and active effort. What this is, it is very similar to, for example, if you come back to the Anapanasati Sutta that we just looked at before, this is very close parallel to what the stage is of Anapanasati. Anapanasati Sutta, the very first one, which is the contemplation of the body. The mind is not yet very strong. It still needs a bit of guidance. And that is that chanda that you require in the first stage of Anapanasati. Similar to what you require also in Satipatthana. Satipatthana too, there are four stages, starting with the body, ending with the Dhammanupassana. There too, it is a graduated sequence. So this is very closely related to what happens in the first four parts of the Anapanasati Sutta that we have just seen. Some degree of chanda is required there. Okay. Please don't get this wrong. It doesn't mean that you should exert enormous amounts of willpower or not. It still means that you should be really kind of chillaxed and just enjoy. That's what it really means. But it means that underlying that, there is some directing of the mind. Otherwise, it's not going to work out usually. Okay, that is the first one. Second one, very similar to the previous one, except one word is changed. If a mendicant depends on energy in order to gain immersion, gain unification of mind, this is called samadhi due to energy. Pali word is virya. You generate enthusiasm, try, make an effort, exert the mind and strive so that the bad, unskillful qualities don't arise. And you have the four right efforts just like before. And these are called the active efforts. And so there is this energy, immersion, samadhi-due to energy, and these active efforts. This is called the foundation of spiritual power that has samadhi due to energy and active effort. So it's exactly the same as the previous one. You have the four right efforts in there. The only difference is this one word that has been changed. Chanda becomes virya. So very repetitive. So it's repetition within repetition. So what does this mean? It means that as your meditation deepens, there comes a point when the energy arises in the mind, as I mentioned before, and the idea of energy is not an application. You don't actually apply the mind as such. It is the natural energy that arises in the mind. Very often comes together with the sati, it comes together with the joy or the gladness. These are kind of qualities that tend to revolve around each other. Yeah, the ideas of mindfulness, pamudja, gladness, and energy. Yeah? They're very closely related to each other. Yeah? When you're energetic, you tend to feel glad, you tend to be mindful, you are present. All of these things are kind of together. Yeah? This is the natural energy of the mind. And when the mind has a natural energy, you don't need much chanda anymore, because at this point, because you have the happiness there, the energy that is there, is almost as if the mind directs itself at this point. Happiness is always a strong draw card, always something that draws you in, and you don't really need so much outside direction. And so chanda kind of dies down, and now the energy is what actually draws you along at this particular point. That is why the energy here becomes the thing that takes you towards samadhi. So different from the previous one. In one sense, these build on each other. So you start off with chanda, then you go on to energy, and then you go on to the, sometimes you go on to the latter ones afterwards. Same principle, and then you can imagine how it works by going back roughly to the Anapanasati Sutta. Then we have the third one. A mendicant depends on mental development in order to gain immersion, gain unification of mind. This is called immersion due to mental development. This is citta. Citta just means mind, really. Dasabdrata translates it here as mental development because it is a particular kind of mind that has been developed to a particular point. And this, if you think back again to the Anapanasati Sutta, the third part there is equivalent to Satipatthana, the citta nupassana, the contemplation of mind. Yeah, and it's all about experiencing the mind, chittang, patisangvedi, and all of these things. And that is part of that. And this is very parallel to that particular part. You're using that mind that you have developed through your meditation. And in this particular context, it means things like the nimitta, yeah, the kind of the light you see in your meditation, all of those kind of things. Not all of those kind of things, but that quite specifically probably is what it refers to. So what it means here is a person who has very developed in meditation. All you have to do is you revert or you focus on that nimitta and you bring that up straight away, you bypass everything else and you use that to go into samadhi very quickly. In the previous one with the energy, if you have a good grasp on how to use things like things that inspire you in meditation, like the Dhammanusati, the Buddhanusati, and all these kind of things. Sometimes all you have to do is reflect on the qualities of the Buddha, or your Kalyanamittas, or the Dhamma, or the Chaga, whatever it is. Straight away the energy comes up because you feel inspired already. You've been on a meditation retreat for a few days and you have a lot of experience with meditation. You just turn your mind in the right direction, the energy comes up, yeah? And you bypass the chanda thing and bang, you just kind of move on with energy. If your meditation is even more powerful, you bypass even the energy aspect. You go straight to those qualities of the mind, bring up the samadhi nimitta, and then you go into samadhi. This is the idea. This one technique is more powerful than the previous one. Each one of them requires more mental development to be able to use. So this is I think, how this works. And it is very parallel to the Anapanasati Sutta, as you can see here. Okay. The last one is the most powerful one of all. a mendicant depends on inquiry to gain immersion, gain unification of mind. This is called samadhi due to inquiry. And again, you generate enthusiasm, try and make an effort, exert the mind and strive so that the bad, unskillful qualities don't arise. And then you have the other four right efforts. They generate enthusiasm, try, make an effort, exert the mind and strive so that bad, unskillful qualities that have arisen are given up. You generate enthusiasm, try, make an effort, exert the mind and strive so that skillful qualities arise. You generate enthusiasm, try, make an effort, exert the mind that the skillful qualities that have arisen remain, are not lost, but increase, mature and are fulfilled by development. You bring this to maturity and to the peak, all these peak experiences that you can have. These are called the active efforts. And so there is inquiry, immersion due to inquiry, and these active efforts. This is called the basis of spiritual power that has samadhi due to inquiry and active efforts. And this last one is the most powerful one, because what you are doing here, this is where it requires a deep understanding of the Dhamma to be able to use this last category. Of course, if you are an Aryan, this is the sort of thing you would use because you understand the nature of happiness and suffering. You understand where to go to look for happiness. It's because you understand these things experientially, you can let go of all the suffering just like that. And you can go into samadhi very quickly. So this has to do with an understanding of the Dhamma. So inquiry here just is like right view. It's like right outlook. Understanding the nature of reality, understanding the problems of the sensory world. So you can abandon the sensory world very fast because you know it is so problematic. You know the true refuge is to be found in meditation practice. There is this nice saying by Ajahn Shah, Ajahn Brahm's teacher, who's saying that your real home is samadhi. Samadhi is your real home because when you go there, finally you feel released from this world, which is so problematic. Finally you find a refuge. Finally you can really relax in your life. You can really let go of everything. So this is the real home. It's like coming back to something very nice, very easy, very enjoyable. This is where this path is taking you. It's wonderful, it's really kind of a powerful thing. So that is the purpose. So once you understand that, where that refuge truly is, and the problems with the rest of the world, how it can never be fixed up, how there is no final solution in this other world, just going around and around, dealing with the same issues again and again and again, forever and ever after. After a while, you just want to get complete aversion. You just want to get rid of all that stuff because you understand how utterly unsatisfactory and problematic it is. And that sort of vimamsa, that sort of insight leads you there. It is not just that. It can be any kind of insight that has to do with the nature of reality. It can be a focus on non-self, for example. It can be a focus maybe on other aspects that the Buddha talks about. And really, it is up to you to make these things work for you. I don't know what inspires you or what makes things work for you. So everyone can do these things in slightly different ways. This is how I sometimes think about this. This is why I bring it up. It's just my own bias, really. It's my own kind of way of thinking about this. This is how you use inquiry, understanding of reality, to push the mind away, and then very quickly you can attain samadhi as a consequence. So these are the four ways, and one is more powerful than the next one. Don't really need to worry too much about it. If you just focus on the mindfulness of breathing, then these foundations of spiritual power, they come along as part and parcel of that. They just happen as a consequence of that. So you don't really have to worry too much about it. But you can tell a little bit about your understanding of the Dhamma by using, for example, the Vimamsa, to see how quickly your mind kind of gives up the world. The deeper your understanding of the Dhamma, the more quickly the mind just settles down and gives up the world because you understand the problem that is involved in the five senses, and also even beyond that, further problems. But that is the most basic kind of problems that we have to deal with. So there you are. This is a bit dry, so because of that, the next sutta is a little bit more wet, fortunately, not as dry as the previous one. So this next one is an example of how this Idipadas are used. And it is not directly relevant, perhaps, to how we practice, but it is a little bit entertaining. Yeah, this is why I thought this one. You need a bit of entertainment as well, otherwise it gets too... and it's kind of, it's not only entertaining, there's a lot of useful things. Every sutta has so much useful information and interesting information in it, and so does this one. So because of that, it's one of the few suttas that relate directly to the Idipadas, and that's why it is interesting as well. So this sutta is at takes place at a place called the Chapala Shrine. Chapala Chaitya. Chaitya is the word for shrine in Pali. What is the difference between Chaitya and Stupa? Sometimes they mean the same thing. Sometimes in the suttas, Chaitya is a bit more broad than Stupa. In the modern day, Chaitya and Stupa is often synonymous, but in the suttas, a Chaitya can be something that is a pre-Buddhist shrine that people would go to, and they might, you know, sit down, or they might do some offerings to the devas or to the ancestors or something like that. But in later times, the real Buddhist Chaitya is the Stupa. The Stupa becomes the Chaitya of Buddhism later on. So it's a bit more broad. So this Chapala Chaitya is a Chaitya that existed in India before the Stupas really started to become important. This was a Chaitya used by all the various parts of the Indian society, not just by the Buddhists, but everyone else as well. So the Buddha would often go to this Chaityas. He would hang out because it was peaceful, it was in the forest, and they would meditate there. They would go there for the days abiding, the Diva Vihara. The days abiding is like the meditation that the monks would, nuns also would do after the meal, and they would go there and spend the whole day kind of in meditation. This is the, when you see the word days abiding, it means meditation practice. It may not be obvious, but that's what it means. And for that reason, actually, Banda Sujato has translated quite nicely as days meditation rather than days abiding, which is a much better translation, actually. Diva Vihara. Vihara is a hut. Vihara is a monastery also in kind of later Buddhism. And it also means, because it means hut and monastery, it also means like an abiding in a sense of a meditation. It's interesting how these words are used, isn't it? How they kind of have this broad number of meanings. Vihara, original meaning, is just a hut. That's what it meant originally in the suttas. But the extension of that is like a kind of a secluded spot within yourself, your own abiding within yourself. So it comes to mean meditation as well. And in later Buddhism, it expands out to mean monastery. And you have to keep all these meanings apart so you know what it means in a particular context. Otherwise, it becomes problematic. Anyway. So let us see what this sutta has to say. So this is again at the Buddha's pass, close to the Buddha's passing away. This is when he is walking from Rajagaha and all the way to Kushinara, and these are some of the events that happen on the way. And this is what happens in Vesali. The Buddha has just spent the rains retreat there, and now after the rains retreat, these are some of the events that happen after the rains retreat. So I have heard, at one time the Buddha was staying near Vesali at the great wood, the Mahavana, in the hall with the peaked roof, the Kutagara Sala. This is a famous place that the Buddha would stay a lot. It was a place that was kept by the Buddhists as a Buddhist monastics, as a monastery here. Then the Buddha robed up in the morning, and taking his bowl and robe, he entered Vesali for alms. Then, after the meal, on his return from alms round, he addressed Venerable Ananda. Ananda, get your sitting cloth. Let's go to the Chapala Shrine for the day's meditation, the Diva Vihara. Yes, sir, replied Ananda. Taking his sitting cloth, he followed behind the Buddha. So, first little point to point out there is this word sitting cloth. Yeah, I don't know how interesting that is to you. It may not be all that interesting, but to me, I'm a monk, very interesting sitting cloth. Nisidana is the Pali word for this. And it's kind of, you can actually see the usage of the sitting cloth in practice. It is when you go out into nature and your robes might get dirty, then you have a cloth that you sit on instead of sitting on the bare ground. This is the purpose of the sitting cloth. Of course, in the present day, you will see monks putting out the sitting cloth and nuns everywhere. Like Venerable Akaliko has very properly put out his sitting cloth. I am a bad example. I haven't put out a sitting cloth. Yes, I'm really... This is how you know a good monk from a bad monk. So this is the original purpose, but these days we tend to use sitting cloths everywhere. But I must admit, I sometimes wonder whether kind of we have gone a bit too far with these sitting cloths. The original purpose is to keep your robes clean. So that's why I'm being a bit rebellious by not using one. Just pointing that out, because the sitting cloth is actually not mentioned very often in the sutta. This is one of the rare occasions when it is mentioned. Then the Buddha went up to the Shapala shrine, sat down on the seat made ready. That would probably just mean the sitting cloth being spread out. Ananda bowed to the Buddha and sat down to one side, and the Buddha said to him, "Ananda, Vesali is lovely. The Udena, the Gotamaka, the Satamba, the Bahuputta, the Sarandada, the Chapala shrines are all lovely. Whoever has developed and cultivated the four foundations of spiritual power, made them a vehicle and a basis, kept them up, consolidated them, and properly implemented them, may, if they wish, live on for the eon or what's left of the eon." The realized one has developed and cultivated these four foundations of spiritual power. He has made them a vehicle and basis, kept them up, consolidated them, and properly implemented them. If he wished, the realized one could live on for the eon, or what's left of the eon. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Don't you get it, Ananda? Maybe he's trying to say something here. What is happening here? And then it goes on, but Ananda didn't get it. Even though the Buddha dropped such an obvious hint, such a clear sign, he didn't beg the Buddha, "Sir, may the Blessed One please remain for the eon. May the Holy One please remain for the eon. That would be for the welfare and happiness of the people, for the benefit, welfare, and happiness of gods and humans. For his mind was as if possessed by Mara." For a second time, a third time, but still Ananda didn't get it, for his mind was as if possessed by Mara. Then the Buddha said to him, "Go now, Ananda, at your own convenience." "Yes, sir," replied Ananda. He rose from his seat, bowed, and respectfully circled the Buddha, keeping him on his right, before sitting down at the tree close by. And then, not long after Ananda had left, Mara the Wicked One went up to the Buddha and said to him, "Sir, may the Blessed One now become fully extinguished. May the Holy One now become fully extinguished. Now is the time for the Buddha to become fully extinguished." "Sir, you once made this statement, 'Wicked One, I will not become fully extinguished until I have monk disciples, nun disciples, layman disciples, laywomen disciples, who are competent, educated, assured, learned, have memorized the teachings, and practiced in line with the teachings. Not until they practice properly, living in line with the teachings, not until they've learned the teacher's doctrine and explain, teach, assert, establish, disclose, and analyze and make it clear. Not until they have legitimately and completely refuted the doctrines of others that come up and teach with a demonstrable basis. Today you do have such disciples. May the Blessed One now become fully extinguished. May the Holy One now become fully extinguished. Now is the time for the Buddha to become fully extinguished." When this was said, the Buddha said to Mara, "Relax, Wicked One." This is Bandhisattva translation. It's good, isn't it? It sounds real. It sounds like someone could actually say that. The final extinguishment of the realized one will be soon. 3 months from now, the realized one will be finally extinguished. So this is a very kind of strange sutta, isn't it? Here, Ananda, the Buddha is asking Ananda to sort out things for him, as if the Buddha cannot make a decision on his own. He needs Ananda to beg him. And then he goes 3 times, and Ananda's mind is possessed by Mara. Yeah, and the Buddha would have known that, presumably. Yes, he would have known that Ananda wasn't in his best mental space, that he was possessed by something. He wasn't very clear. Presumably he would have known that, because he wasn't able to reply. And what is even worse is that later on in the same sutta, it says that the Buddha had not done it only once, but it lists a large number of places where the Buddha is supposed to have said exactly the same thing. And every time, poor old Ananda's mind was possessed by Mara. So if you count the number of times, it comes up to maybe 50 times or something like that, or maybe more. And every time, the same kind of thing. It's why isn't the Buddha able to make his own decision? Doesn't the Buddha know when it is the right time to pass away, when it's not? Does he have to rely on some kind of strange strategy to decide whether he's going to live or not? Does this make any sense? It doesn't make any sense to me. I don't know about you, but to me it makes absolutely no sense at all. I find this really weird. The Buddha should rely on some kind of uncertain strategy like this. It doesn't, to me, it goes against how the Buddha always works and how he deals with things in the suttas. The way he deals with things is that he knows what is happening and he makes decisions based on what is right. So what is going on if this isn't real? What is actually happening? What is actually happening here? And what I think is happening here is that we have already seen before, I mentioned before, how the Buddha is very ill towards the end of his life. He almost passes away. Yeah, he has to use his energy to overcome the illness. And this is one of the themes that go through the whole Mahaparinibbana Sutta, how the Buddha is gradually, the body is gradually falling apart, is getting more and more ill. Towards the very end, he has to stop and rest all the time. You can imagine if you're very close to your death, you're very, your body's falling apart, of course, you're not going to have much energy. And still, he's walking along. Yeah, it's astonishing that you can even walk along on the very last day of your life like that. So the whole theme of the Parinibbana Sutta is one of an old man basically dying. Yeah, it's difficult to think of the Buddha like that, because not usually how we think about the Buddha, but that is what is going on there. It's a very natural process of the body falling apart. And I think that later Buddhists, they were not happy with that. Yeah, they were not, the Buddha was too important to just fall apart like an old person falls apart. But of course, that is what the Buddha reminds us of all the time, that this is what happens to the body. But the later Buddhists were not happy with that. They needed some kind of better explanation for why the Buddha passed away. And so they use poor Ananda here as the cause for the Buddha's passing away. Yeah, he is the fall guy. He has to take the responsibility for the Buddha dying eventually. So they come up with this strategy. Yeah, the Buddha gives all of these hints, not only once, but 50 times the Buddha gives the hint. Every time Ananda is too silly or too possessed by Mara to get it. Yeah, and then eventually the Buddha says, okay, yeah, whatever, if you don't get it, I'm just going to die, yeah? Does that sound like the Buddha? It doesn't sound like the Buddha, yeah? The Buddha doesn't think like that. But that's almost how it comes out. So this is the only way I can really resolve this inherent tension in the sutta between, on the one hand, very natural elements, the Buddha passing away with an ordinary human body just like everyone else, and then this other thing where the Buddha is supposed to be able to keep his body going for an eon. Imagine the idea of having the body going for an eon. Only an editor which didn't really understand the Dhamma fully could come up with an idea like that. Yeah, how can we think about the human body lasting for an eon? The human body looks bad enough after 80 or 100 years. After an eon, it would look pretty, I don't know, I don't even dare to think what it would look like after an eon. But it would be pretty scary, I think. So it doesn't make any sense. Of course, so this is why this whole thing about the Buddha living on for the eon is very strange. There are attempts to get around that. The commentators of the Pali Suttas were not comfortable with the idea that the Buddha should live for an aeon. So they redefined this word. The Pali word is kappa, and they redefined this word to mean lifetime rather than aeon. That's a very kind of a convenient way of getting around the problem. You just take the word, you say, actually, it doesn't mean what it always means, it means something else. In this case, the word elephant doesn't mean elephant. In this case, the word elephant means cheese. So we call it cheese instead. Yeah, it's a bit like that. We just kind of redefine it for our purposes. But the point is that the word kappa always means aeon in the sutta. That's what it means. So I think rather than redefine it in that way by the commentators because they didn't feel comfortable with it, we need to ask for a more deep reason why these things actually are there in the suttas. And it opens up a different perspective on what is going on. And it's one of those very important things to realize about the suttas is that they are, a large part of them is just the word of the Buddha. And that has been kept largely intact over 2,500 years. But a significant part of the suttas are also there because of the editors that added things to the suttas, especially the narrative part, not the actual word of the Buddha, but the framing narrative that talks about where the Buddha was, who he was talking to, how many monks did and did not become enlightened afterwards, and the nuns and the lay people, all of that. And especially the Mahapanibbana Sutta is to a large extent narrative. So because of that, you can expect that a large part of what is in there is not necessarily, some of it, a lot of it may very well be authentic, but it is quite possible that a large part of it is not authentic. And what is interesting is that once you start to compare the Mahapanibbana Sutta with the other versions of the same sutta, it exists in about 3 different versions in Chinese translation. Yeah, different Chinese versions, because the Chinese canon is so enormous. It has different schools of Buddhism and all that, so it has the Mahapanibbana Sutta in many versions. There is a Sanskrit version of this. And if you start to compare all of these versions, you find out that all of the supernatural elements vary in almost all of these versions. All of them have a lot of supernatural elements, but not the same ones. They're all different. That makes you wonder, how authentic can it be if it varies so much? The doctrinal part, the actual teachings, tend to be the same across all the versions because it has obviously been kept by a very conservative mind frame that wanted to conserve the Buddha's teachings for the future. It is the teaching of the Buddha that really matters. But what has been added on by the editors, because the editors of the various schools may have been different, the editing actually varies a lot. So all the supernormal phenomena are different. Everyone wanted supernormal phenomena because everyone wanted to elevate the Buddha into something special, but they couldn't agree with each other, or they were already separated into different schools or whatever, so they're all different. And this, it is in that context that idea, such as the idea of the Buddha being able to live on for the aeon, kind of how these things emerge. This particular idea, I think, is there in all the versions of the sutta, but that doesn't mean that it hasn't been added. It may have been added at an early point when the schools were still unified. And that's what I think is going on. Because there is this tension throughout the Mahapanibbana Sutta. On the one hand, you have all the natural elements, naturalistic elements. On the other hand, you have all the supernormal elements. And there is a clash between these things throughout the sutta. Always when I see the clash, I always think that the naturalistic elements are much more likely to be true. Simply because all the supernormal phenomena, they tend to be problematic throughout the suttas. This does not mean that I don't think any of these things are possible. I do. It's just that the way they are written about, the way they come out in the suttas, often is not the way that things actually happened. So I think we can get poor old Venerable Ananda off the hook, yeah? And we can, he doesn't have to take the whole responsibility for the Buddha's passing away, fortunately. Imagine the burden, yeah? Imagine the kind of how to carry that with you for the rest of your life. This is your fault that the Buddha passed away. It's kind of pretty jeepish. That's a bit rough. So that is my take on that. And I tend to be a kind of a skeptical kind of person. I
iconoclast. No, I'm not really an iconoclast. That would be going too far. But I tend to be kind of, you know, probably some monks would say I'm a really bad monk because I have these kind of ideas. But actually, I think it's really important to have this kind of intelligent appraisal of the suttas and not to be neither too gullible nor too critical. Have that middle way, that kind of reasonable understanding. Of course, I always think that my way is the middle way, yeah? Other people think that their way is the middle way, and they don't. They're not the same middle way. So who is right? Which middle way is right? Well, you have to find that out for yourself. But this is kind of what I'm trying to achieve anyway, is a middle way, not being too gullible and not being too critical, but finding a kind of a decent medium, a middle path that seems to work. So anyway. If after Venerable Ananda has failed to convince the Buddha, then Mara comes, and he, of course, is able to convince the Buddha. Yeah, this kind of makes the whole thing even less kind of satisfactory. Yes, Mara, I will do exactly as you say. No problem, I will pass away very soon. But what is interesting about this little conversation that he has with Mara, there is a few things in that conversation that actually are worth pointing to, because these are also very important for the history of Buddhism and for the way we deal with Buddhism in the present day. And you will notice there that Mara is saying to the Buddha that sometime in the past he has said he wants to establish this religion or this teaching where that has four assemblies. And this is quite a common thing in the suttas. For example, in another sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya, the Buddha is said to have had a dream, yeah, before, even before his awakening, had a dream of four assemblies, yeah, again. So this seems to have been something that actually was there from the very beginning almost, the idea that the Buddha was going to establish a solid kind of a religion or teaching in the world that then could carry on into the future. And one of those four assemblies, of course, is the assembly of nuns. Yeah, so this seems to have been the Buddha's, from this, the intention from the very beginning to have an assembly of nuns or a sangha of nuns or bhikkhunis. And that is a very important statement because it puts into context the idea later on when the Buddha is seeming to refuse to ordain women. You have that in the in the Vinaya Pitaka, where you have the story of Mahapajapati going to the Buddha and asking for ordination, and he says no, it's not going to happen, and etc. And then Venerable Ananda again Venerable Ananda comes and asks the Buddha why not, and then he's able to convince the Buddha. Again, it's a bit strange. Does the Buddha really need convincing, or doesn't he know what he's doing? It's a bit weird. So it makes more sense to me that the Buddha knew what he was doing and that he actually had decided this from the very beginning. So why then was he reluctant in the that story from the Vinaya Pitaka? Why did he say no to Mahapajapati Gotami at the beginning? And the answer to that may be, and this is something again you can study through studying comparative versions of these suttas, is that he realized that actually it was quite dangerous for women to become renunciants at that time. You needed to have a proper framework, you needed to have proper facilities and all these kind of things. They couldn't just kind of go off and live in the forest on their own. It would be too dangerous. So because of that, that seems to have been one of the reasons why he was reluctant initially to ordain. It had to be the right time and right place. And there is some evidence in the other versions of these events found in other schools of Buddhism to show that that might actually be the reason why he was reluctant. So then again, then it starts to make more sense. Yeah, it makes sense. Well, if we're going to have bhikkhunis, we're going to have to do it properly. We can't just kind of mess around and put people in danger. It doesn't make any sense. So we do things in the right way. And that may be the cause for that. Then it fits with the idea that he actually wanted to have women from the very beginning. So sometimes seeing things in perspective, seeing them from different angles, these things come out and the things start to kind of hang together quite nicely. So that is the first thing that comes out of this, which is, I think, very important in this particular sutta. The other one that you will notice here, which is interesting, it talks about the four assemblies, the lay and the ordained, men and women. And it talks about all of these assemblies being competent, educated, assured, confident, learn it, have it memorized the teachings, yeah, and practice in line with the teachings. Not only that, but they are practicing it and they have learned the doctrine and they can explain, teach, assert, establish, disclose, analyze, and make it clear. And then you can even refute the doctrines of others. Yeah, so this is kind of this is the job of all the four assemblies. So your job is to go to all those Christians, yeah, knock on the doors and refute the doctrine. Are you ready for that? I'm challenging. No, I'm just joking. And that's not the point. What is the point of that? Buddhism is not really that kind of teaching. What is the point? The point is just to have enough confidence about these teachings, enough certainty that if questions come up and you are uncertain about things, you know how those teachings are refuted from a Buddhist perspective. It's more like internal to the Buddhist community than going around knocking on doors and converting people. Yeah? So you can breathe easily. You don't have to go out and knock on people's doors. You can relax instead. So this is what it really means. But having that ability to understand other teachings, doctrine, in light of the Buddhist teaching, actually is very important. Because once you understand that, you can see how all of these things actually fit together, and why there is a distinction, how Buddhism is different, and how these things emerge out of meditation and insight into reality. It's very, very important to understand, because then you feel much more confident. And when a Christian comes to you and says, "Oh, you need to, you know, Buddhism is really bad because it's all about suffering," you know the answer. You know what to say. When the Christians say, and this happens in many places in Buddhist countries, they go and say, "Oh, the Buddha was really bad because he left his wife and child back home, and he just ordained. What kind of husband would do that? He's a bad person. Yeah, so you better become Christians because Jesus, he's much nicer than the Buddha." That kind of thing. Yeah, and then you know the answers to these things. You know why that actually is not really how it works, and why it is different. You understand what is going on. So it is very useful, important to have this clarity about things, so people can't just mess around with you too easily. So that is one thing. But what is interesting about this is you will notice that it is not just the monastic's job to here preserve the teachings. It is also the job of the lay people. Yeah, the lay people understanding these teachings properly, analyzing them, practicing them, having the ability to fully understand these things in depth. And this is fascinating because in the modern world it is very common for monastics to kind of have this hierarchy in Buddhism, where the monastics are always at the top of the hierarchy. Not always, but very often. And it depends a little bit which Buddhist country you go to. It varies a little bit, but it is a very common thing. But here you can see it doesn't have to be like that. Sometimes it can be different. Sometimes the lay people are the ones who probably should be doing the teaching because they might know more. There are some lay people who are incredibly knowledgeable about the suttas, some lay people who get really good meditation, and so why shouldn't they be teachers? And this is one of the things I like about Sri Lanka, is that in Sri Lanka, it is not so hierarchical as it is in other countries. In Sri Lanka, sometimes monks, they go and listen to a teaching by a layperson, yeah? And that is perfectly acceptable within Sri Lankan society, which I think is good, because that is actually how the Buddha said it should be. It is whoever has the understanding, they are the one who actually act as the teacher. Whereas in some other Buddhist countries, it is so hierarchical that if you are a monk and you open your mouth and you just blabber complete nonsense, after you have spoken lots of nonsense, everyone says, "Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu." You know, they put the bar so low, it's actually, the bar is underground. You can't. It's impossible not to clear the bar. It's just everyone's going to clear that bar. So, and this is, it gets silly sometimes. There should be a little bit of, it's good that lay people have a little bit of critical faculties, because this is how ultimately we keep Buddhism afloat, by having some standards as to what is acceptable and not. This is very interesting. And it also reminds me of a little sutta, which I usually mention on this retreat. It's from the Anguttara Nikaya. It's the Ugga, the householder. I think it's Ugga or Citta, one of these. I think it's Ugga, the householder. And he was a very famous householder at that time, and he was supposed to be an anagami, non-returner householder man. And he was the one, he had three wives, And when he became an anagama, he said to his wives, yeah, you know, do whatever you want, you know, find yourself another man, because you may not find it all that interesting to live with me anymore, yeah? So go off and find yourself another husband. So his wives, a couple of his wives went off, but the third one, she stayed around him, because maybe because she realized it was very useful to have a husband who was so wise or something like that. So Ugga the householder, the anagami, and he would invite the monastic sangha to his house. And then when he invited the monastic sangha to his house, he was always respectful to all the monks, even though he was probably wiser than all of them. And then he would invite them. He would invite the monks to teach. And if the monks refused to teach, then he would teach the monks instead. Yeah, this is Ugga the householder. So you can, so this is how it was sometimes at the time of the Buddha. So it wasn't so hierarchical as it sometimes is in the present day. So good to remember that. Yeah, we need to use our resources well. The Buddhist community is still quite small in a country like Australia and in many, many countries around the world. And we need to use our resources wisely. And we need to be smart about how we kind of how we work together, the lay community and the Sangha. And if we use our resources wisely, we can go much further than we can if we don't do that. And here is one of those statements by the Buddha where he kind of really is encouraging everyone to take their share of these things, especially if you have the abilities. And we try to do that a little bit at the Buddhist Society. Probably not enough, but a little bit, because we have, you know, on Saturdays we have lay people teaching meditation. During the rains retreat we have lay people giving talks sometimes. And I think that's a wonderful thing. Maybe we should have more of that, but at least we have some of it, which is already a good start. Anyway, so this is just an example of the Iddhipadas. And you can see here how the Iddhipadas are connected with psychic powers, the ability to live on for the aeon, and often they are connected also with other psychic powers as well. That is why the Iddhipadas are sometimes kind of a bit special. But the main purpose of the Iddhipadas is not for all kind of weird psychic powers. The main purpose of them is to give rise to awakening. Yeah, the one psychic power that really matters, the awakening experience itself. One interesting word here at the very end there, it says that teach with a demonstrable basis. And the word there for demonstrable is patiharya. Patiharya means like a marvel or a wonder. It's like teaching with a wonder, yeah, with a kind of wonderful teaching. Yeah. And in Buddhism, remember, the real wonder in Buddhism, the real miracle in Buddhism, not the psychic powers. The real miracle in Buddhism is the miracle of teaching, the anusasana patiharya. Anusasana patiharya, why is that a miracle? It's a miracle that a teaching that is so profound can be transferred from teacher to student by verbal teaching. That is really the kind of the miracle there. It's the wonder that happens when the Buddha teaches Anya Kondanya in the first Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, and the Buddha says, wow, Kondanya understands Anyasi Vatabo. Vatabo means like, whoa, amazing, astonishing. Yeah, Anyasi Vatabo, Kondanya. Anyasi means he understands. Kondanya understands, amazing. And because he didn't know yet whether the teaching was going to be effective or going to work or not, this is the real miracle in Buddhism, the miracle of teaching, that you can pass on even such profound teachings verbally through one thing, through one generation to the other one. This is what I think might be the meaning here as well, with a demonstrable basis, with a wonder working of the Dhamma in that way. Okay. That is the four Iddhipadas, quite a brief one. So that is the a third of these sets that we're having a look at. And that completes that. And tomorrow we can move on to the five spiritual faculties. Before that, I will also come out again, as always, this evening at 7:30. So see you back again at 7:30 this evening.